The many victims of Bernard Madoff are still looking for their money. At the same time, many writers are looking for answers. They're trying to better understand the man who admitted running a multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme. Half a dozen books have now been published about the scandal, and we're going to review some of them this morning with NPR's Jim Zaroli. He covered the Madoff story as it unfolded. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I want to start with what's known here. Bernard Madoff, billions of dollars disappeared, a guilty plea, lots of bright people who seem to lose everything. What's unknown here?
I think what we've never really had is sort of a look inside the operation, and there are big questions about how it worked and who knew what. For instance, Madoff had a lot of his relatives working in the firm in one way or another. A lot of other people, too. We don't really know at this point how many of them knew what was going on, to what extent they knew, what Madoff told them. And I think that's really what we're going to find out in the months ahead.
And what some of these authors try to take a swing at. The first we'll talk about is Jerry Oppenheimer. The book is called Madoff with the Money. Who is he and what approach does he take?
Well, you know, I would say that the tone of the book is a little bit more tabloidy than some of the others. Jerry Oppenheimer is a writer who's had some best-selling books in the past. It's an interesting book, and one of the things it says is that there really was something almost kind of a little sleazy about Bernie Madoff from the beginning. You might almost say he was born into it. His mother, who was a housewife in Queens, ran what appears to have been an illegal stock trading operation that was shut down by the SEC. Oppenheimer makes the case that Madoff basically got his start doing business with a firm that was manipulating stock prices. It may even have had ties to the mafia. And this went on throughout Bernie Madoff's career. At one point, he paid two accountants to raise money for him, even though they weren't registered as investment advisors. They later got in trouble with the SEC. So Bernie Madoff had this very respectable sort of elder statesman image on Wall Street. It was something he had built up for himself. But really, as Jerry Oppenheimer's book makes clear, he was somebody who had a long history of sort of skirting the law in different ways.
So the theory of Bernie Madoff is almost a character from the movie Double Indemnity, somebody who is basically a good guy but has gradually gotten himself in more and more trouble. That doesn't ring true for Jerry Oppenheimer.
No, and I have to say that in the beginning, that was what I thought Bernie Madoff was about. But I think as time has gone on, it's been kind of hard to keep believing that. And I think Jerry Oppenheimer just adds more evidence to that.
So that's one take on Bernie Madoff. What about this book here, Betrayal, The Life and Lies of Bernie Madoff by Andrew Kurtzman?
Well, I think Andrew Kurtzman's book is probably the most readable of the books, especially for people who don't know a lot about Madoff. It kind of reads more like a novel. One of the things that Kurtzman did was he talked to some of the people who worked inside Madoff's office, and he has some interesting things to say about the SEC. He says that the SEC would send these very young, very inexperienced staff members in to question Madoff anytime they did an investigation. And these young people would come into Madoff's office, which was in the Lipstick Building in Midtown, beautiful offices, and they would just look around and they would get bowled over. They would get intimidated. And sometimes they would even ask the staff, you know, are there any jobs open here?
So we begin to get a sense of perhaps not exactly his financial method, but at least his style. It ran in the family, or so it seems, and he had a very impressive presence, great salesmanship or intimidating salesmanship, even with the SEC. What, if anything, gets added to that picture by the next book on our list here, Madoff, Too Good to Be True by Aaron Arvidland?
Now, Erin Arvidland is a financial reporter for Barron's, and she is always going to be remembered for having written an article questioning Madoff's returns way back in 2001. It caused kind of a minor stir on Wall Street. She's very good at explaining the financial side to this, which is really a huge part of the story, in particular how Bernie Madoff was able to build up this huge network of feeder funds and banks that kept funneling money to him over the years. I mean, he was not out, for the most part, asking people for money. They came to him. And one of the reasons why he could do that was because he had all these funds that were collecting money and giving it to him to invest.
We're talking with NPR's Jim Zaroli, who covered the Bernard Madoff scandal and has been reading some of the new books about it. And Jim, so far, these are books we've been discussing by writers who did not personally know Madoff, although they talked to everybody they could. This last work is an exception to that.
Yeah, this was Madoff's Other Secret, Love, Money, Bernie, and Me, and it was written by Cheryl Weinstein. She was the chief financial officer at Hadassah, which is a Jewish women's charity. Hadassah, over the years, had invested about $40 million with Madoff, and she says Hadassah would try to find out what they could about Madoff. They tried to find out how he could get these returns, but he refused to answer questions. He would not meet with the financial advisory committee of the organization. She actually ended up having an affair with Madoff, which lasted for about a year and a half. I spoke with Cheryl Weinstein recently.
I think one of the reasons maybe Bernie liked me was I didn't ask too many questions. I'm the type of person that I let people disclose themselves rather than ask more and more questions. And I think if I had been the type that asked more and more questions, he probably wouldn't have liked that.
I wonder if she had been the type who asked more and more questions if Hadassah would not have invested their money with Madoff.
Yeah, I think that's undoubtedly true. But then again, not many people did that and not many charities did that either, which is why so many of them lost so much money.
Jim Zarola, these books do seem to give a richer and richer sense of Bernard Madoff's personality, his background, his salesmanship, his style. But do you, in reading them, get any better sense of where the money went?
You really don't. And that's one of the things that law enforcement officials are still looking at. And I think we are going to know more. One of Madoff's top aides, Frank DiPasquale, is now cooperating with the government. And he's going to shed a lot more light on how Madoff's operation worked. But the definitive Bernie Madoff book is yet to be written.
NPR's Jim Zarola, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And you can find more about those books at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Finally, a few more words about last week's rudeness outbreak. Last week, I talked about why South Carolina Congressman Joe Wilson's outburst during President Obama's address actually does matter, and why it was a bit more than just the distraction Wilson's partisans were making it out to be. Well, since then, there have been additional developments. The House voted largely, but not entirely, along party lines to reprimand him, a purely symbolic gesture with no force at all other than prolonging whatever embarrassment Representative Wilson may or may not feel. Then, former President Jimmy Carter said he believes some of the animosity directed at President Obama is related to his race. Carter said some people simply cannot tolerate the fact that an African American is running the country. And as for me, well, I received the predictable flood of insults from people who think if you mention race or think about race, then you're whining, you're crying, and you should just shut up and go away. Can I just tell you, I personally am over it. I think it's long past time to get down to the business of figuring out how to get more people access to health care and how to pay for it. But one listener raised a thoughtful question I did want to answer. She asked why I didn't also mention Kanye West's ridiculous behavior toward Taylor Swift during the MTV Awards.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm going to let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time. One of the best videos of all time.
And Serena Williams' over-the-top outburst at the line judge during last week's U.S. Open.
I didn't say I would kill you. Are you serious?
For the record, they were both wrong. So wrong. And I could even argue on a personal level their behavior was even more egregious than Congressman Wilson's because, as we all know, if you're going to pick on somebody, you should pick on somebody your own size. In both cases, West and Williams, and let's not forget Roger Federer, who also cursed at a line judge 2 days after Serena did, went after people far less famous and with far less stature. But just because Kanye and Serena and Roger Federer are more famous than Joe Wilson does not make them more important. I did not mention them last week because I think that what public officials do matters more than the actions of artists and athletes. What public officials do matters more because they ostensibly represent not just themselves and their own constituents, but a civic ideal. And while many sports are ritualized conflict, and hip-hop can be, the whole purpose of an elected body in a democracy is to resolve real conflicts according to the rule of law. and according to the rule of civil society. Quite simply, I hold elected officials to a higher standard than hip-hop artists or tennis stars, even rich and famous ones. On the broader issue, does race matter in Wilson's outburst, or for that matter, in the town halls? Who can really be sure? But I do know that efforts to dismiss race out of hand ring hollow. New York Times columnist David Brooks said he decided race was not a factor because when he was jogging on the mall the weekend before last, he saw white anti-Obama protesters buying food at and joining a concert put on by an event called the Black Family Reunion. Well, excuse me, as the example of Joe Wilson's political patron, the late South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond, reminds us, some white people have been eating black people's food and listening to their music and, yes, having sex with them for centuries, without being willing to grant black and brown people human dignity, civil rights, or the authority to govern. The fact is that our racial history, rooted in systems of bondage based on race, has a very deep stem. It's like a virus that we don't even know we have until it's making us sick. It's in the white flight attendant who bristles at hanging up a black man's jacket and doesn't know why, the black teacher who resents having to teach Latinos, the Asian girl who thinks she can't ask for help doing her math. Yes, it's in the black teen who overreacts to any perceived slight, and the white teen who thinks black culture is all saggy pants and do-rags. Our racial history has left such profound scars on the psyches of so many of us that I really don't see how any thinking person can ignore the damage. Perhaps the time we spend pretending that race is not an issue could be better spent thinking about how to bring about that colorblind reality. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Today we begin a new series, which we call Are You Covered? It looks at the various ways that Americans get health insurance, or don't. Our first story looks at a statement that you have most likely heard from the president or from a member of Congress or from any number of congressional candidates over the years. The statement that everyone should have the same choices that federal workers have when it comes to health insurance. NPR's Joseph Shapiro has more.
Tony Bethay picks a tiny glass bottle off the kitchen counter.
This is what keeps me alive.
The clear liquid inside is insulin.
I was 5 years old when I was first diagnosed with diabetes.
She's 13 now and starting high school. She's pretty, smiling, and stylish, from her bangs angled across her forehead to her sparkly red fingernails. Tony's had type 1 diabetes for as long as she can remember.
At five, I really didn't know what was going on, but I remember having my mother and my grandfather holding me down to give me shots and prick my fingers, and I was scared, I was confused, and it wasn't a good time.
Rhonda Dorsey is Tony's mother.
In order to live a healthy life with type 1 diabetes or any kind of chronic illness, it's so important to have good insurance. And I tell Tony all the time how blessed we are because we've met a lot of people who don't have insurance at all, and insurance that covers Tony as well as it does.
Rhonda Dorsey has good insurance because she works for the federal government. She's covered by the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. It insures 8 million workers, retirees, and their families, and members of Congress. And they do report high levels of satisfaction. Still, it's not some kind of super insurance. It's pretty much like most insurance people get through their jobs. Federal workers, including Rhonda Dorsey, sometimes complain about the rising costs of their premiums and copayments and about the hassles of getting care. In those early stressful days of her daughter's illness, Rhonda belonged to a traditional HMO.
I'd always have to get a referral.
She'd take Tony to see an endocrinologist, an eye doctor, and one specialist after another.
And sometimes I would forget, and I'd get to the doctor's office, and it would be a mess. And so I'd be very apologetic, and we'd have to call the pediatrician's office. And it just was a waste of time, in my opinion.
There were limits, too, on the supplies she needed to manage Tony's diabetes. Sometimes a prescription refill for needles or testing strips would be denied. So Rhonda switched insurance companies. Her new plan allows her to keep taking her daughter back to the specialists who know her best.
And I have the standard plan, which means that I pay a little bit more up front. My deductible is a little bit higher, but I don't have to deal with the referrals. I can go to any doctor.
And that's what makes the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program stand out compared to other insurance. Choice. Most federal employees have lots of choices for health insurance. In the Washington, D.C. area where Rhonda lives, there are at least 16 health plans to choose from. Nationwide, most companies offer only one health plan to their employees, and just 1% of companies offer three or more. That's according to the Kaiser Family Foundation.
That is one good thing about the federal benefit is that you have numerous options. And I don't remember how many, but it was quite a few. It was enough for me to have to do my homework to check to see which one would, best suit our needs.
Even with good insurance, it's expensive to manage diabetes. Toni pricks her calloused fingertips several times a day to check her blood sugar levels. Rhonda pays a little more than $200 a month for supplies. Toni wears an insulin pump. It's the size of a cell phone, and it's pink.
It had to be pink.
This is her. This pink is definitely her style.
The first pump costs $5,000. Insurance paid all but $500. Toni knows she's fortunate. This summer, she went to a summer camp for kids with diabetes, and she saw what kids do when they don't have good health insurance.
At camp, they provide you with supplies, but I've seen kids who have saved their needles and taken them with them. Even though you weren't, supposed to, they would kind of sneak them just to make sure that they would have something when they got back home.
Toni and Rhonda know that when people don't have good insurance, they're so desperate they'll even reuse a needle.
It gets dull, and so it really hurts. But you have to have insulin, just like I said. I mean, without insulin, Toni would die. So you take the pain in order to live.
I do feel very grateful for all that I have because that could be me.
Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Internet has gone largely unregulated since it came into being more than 30 years ago, and that may be one of its charms. But today, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission announced his intention to change that, as NPR's Neda Ulaby reports.
Julius Jenikowski's speech at the Brookings Institution was the telecommunications equivalent of a nightstick rattling across a railing.
I believe the Federal Communications Commission must be a smart cop on the beat, preserving a free and open Internet.
The Internet was founded on the principle of sharing information, but Jenikowski says that's changed. Companies are learning how to manipulate and control information, both political and commercial, and how quickly you can get it. For example, a huge company can pay for its pages to open faster than those of a little company.
We could see the Internet's doors shut to entrepreneurs, the spirit of innovation stifled, a full and free flow of information compromised, or we could take steps to preserve Internet openness.
To that end, Jenikowski proposed six steps, FCC regulations that revolve around what's called net neutrality, which has as its tenets consumer choice and corporate transparency. David Young is vice president of regulatory affairs for Verizon. He did his best to sound hopeful about the prospect of government regulation.
I'm pleased to hear that the chairman intends to do only as much as needed and no more.
What Jenikowski intends to do is preserve the Internet's open architecture, which he says benefits businesses of all sizes and ordinary people. In fact, his admirers say he's trying to constructively bring them together.
What the chairman is laying out is a policy that says that you can use any software you want on any device you want. So, for example, you can use Skype on your mobile phone.
And you are, by the way?
I'm the CEO of Skype. My name is Josh Silverman.
Skype lets you use your computer to call other Skype users for free. And at a moment when our computers and cell phones are becoming the same thing, FCC Chairman Julius Jenikowski says companies need to realize their consumers' needs and their own bottom lines may just be the same thing. Neda Ulaby, NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Remember when the scariest environmental villains were chemicals destroying the ozone layer? Well, back in 1987, the most effective environmental treaty ever was passed, and it eliminated that problem. But as NPR's Richard Harris reports, it may have created a new problem.
In the basement of the Hart Senate office building on Capitol Hill, a thirsty staffer feeds a few coins into one of the many soda machines. As it happens, machines like this, along with refrigerators and air conditioners, use gases called HFCs as coolants. HFCs are non-flammable and they don't hurt the ozone. But Kurt Davies at Greenpeace says when it comes to global warming, they're not so good.
These gases are tremendously powerful greenhouse gases. We call them the super greenhouse gases. They're the global warming threat that no one's really heard about.
Molecule for molecule, they are hundreds of times better at trapping heat in the atmosphere than the most important greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide. HFCs were invented as a replacement for refrigerants like CFCs, which were destroying ozone. The good news is at the moment HFCs are only responsible for a few percent of human-induced global warming. Samuel Labuddy from a small nonprofit called the Environmental Investigation Agency says the bad news is global production is poised to take off to satisfy the world's growing desire for fridges and air conditioners.
Right now, what's happening is that China and India are beginning to invest very, very heavily in HFC production.
Labuddy's group started out investigating the illegal trade of banned ozone-destroying chemicals, but they quickly realized that the perfectly legal trade in HFCs could do far more damage if the industry grows as fast as is now projected.
So much so that by 2050, the global warming effects of HFCs will be sufficient to cancel out all the reductions in CO2 that we're looking at getting under the United Nations Copenhagen Climate Talks Agreement and things of that nature.
Environmental groups have been trying to do something about HFCs for well over a decade. Finally, there's progress. Two small countries have proposed phasing out the chemicals by amending the treaty that protects our ozone layer, the 1987 Montreal Protocol. Last week, the United States, Canada, and Mexico agreed to support a treaty amendment that wouldn't ban HFCs entirely, but that would dramatically reduce their production. Of course, that means the air conditioning and refrigeration industries have to find something else to use. And that brings us back to the soda machines in the Senate office building. Kurt Davies from Greenpeace feeds a couple of dollar bills into a Pepsi machine.
Bit of a robot machine, isn't it? I've never seen that before. It kind of picks it up and gives it to you.
The robot is showy, but that's not the real point of this test machine.
What's novel about this machine is that it's not like the old-fashioned vending machines or your refrigerator at home. The cooling is done with carbon dioxide.
Which is a greenhouse gas, but these machines use so little that that's not an issue. The machine is not only free of HFCs, it also uses less electricity. Carbon dioxide doesn't work in refrigerators, but hydrocarbons like propane and isobutane do. In fact, there are in 100 million fridges worldwide. Problem solved?
Well, it's not as simple as it sounds.
Karim Onran is at the Air Conditioning, Heating and Refrigeration Institute, a trade group. He says carbon dioxide may work in vending machines, but it would never work to run the huge air chillers in the hotel where we meet, and neither would flammable chemicals like isobutane.
Imagine if you had 1,000 pounds or more of isobutane in your chiller in this building and something happened. I mean, the entire building probably will be wiped out.
Even so, his industry knows that HFCs will eventually have to go, so they are now scrambling to find substitutes that will solve the current problem without creating yet another. Richard Harris, NPR News.